Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mailer here. My first guest today, Steve Ackerman, with us right now. He normally talks about weather. He will be talking about weather at 11:45, but to start the show, we're going to be talking about his new role as Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. Going to learn more about how research is conducted at UW, what different kinds of research we have going on, and we'll take your questions as well. So, what do you want to know about research studies at UW? What do you want to learn about participating in campus studies? Maybe you've already participated in some studies. Maybe you were part of a research team and have some comments about it. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Steve Ackerman, welcome. It's great to have you with us in your new role.
Hey, Larry, how you doing? It's great to be back on here talking about something other than weather, which is always fun.
Well, I tell you what, talk about your new position. What duties do you have? What's your role?
My new position is the Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education. So graduate education falls under our office as well as research across campus. We have responsibilities for reviewing graduate education programs on that side of the job, as well as on the research side of the job. We work closely with WARF and faculty and researchers across campus, trying to support research, to design programs that enable researchers to start new research directions, as well as to try and get new faculty here by helping them with their startup needs when they first come here. So it's a big job. It's a great job so far, anyway. COVID-19 kind of put a little damper on that. Because what we're really trying to do is really try and increase the amount of research, allow people to achieve their professional goals with regard to the research that they conduct on campus as their profession.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, it's been a great job. I started right on around March 9th officially, which is when we started closing campus down. So it's been an interesting time.
Well, you know, the UW-Madison, it's a research university. And how does that differ from other colleges, university? What does that mean? It's a pretty big deal, research here at UW.
It really is a big deal. And it means that our faculty, when they come here, are expected to do teaching, you know, so work on the education part, but also to do research and scholarship, and then also to do service. Because, as you know, the Wisconsin idea is a really big part, I think, of the culture of Wisconsin. And so the research enterprise across campus is large, and it's very diverse. I mean, we have people studying the formation of galaxies, you know, to people doing nanotechnologies and looking at how do you discover new molecules that form. So we really span the spatial scale of what we do, but also the biological scale from, you know, looking at the interaction of cells with one another, and then taking that all the way up to the environment in terms of how does a particular chemical or reagent react with the environment as a whole. And then, of course, on top of that, there's also, you know, the arts and the humanities and the research that they do. As they explore new ways of communicating via the arts. So it's pretty broad, which makes it, again, a really interesting job.
Yeah, that's for sure. And the amount of research dollars that come in as the result of faculty efforts, research efforts, there's a dollar total that's pretty large.
Yeah, so our research funding in terms of the amount that gets spent and comes into the university is on the order of $1.2 billion. So big amount of research.
Per year.
Per year, yep. And a lot of that is federal grants as well.
And we have callers online, I think, with some questions for you. Let's take a call. Mark in New Glarus, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Steve and Larry. Hey, I'm just wondering if there are any projects that might be 10 or 20 years down the road, but if they come to fruition, might really change humanity. How's that for a little Monday morning?
Oh, yes. You know, and the answer to that is yes. Now, if you ask me which ones, I'm going to say I don't know, right? And the reason why I confidently say yes is because if you look at some of the work that has been done on campus, it has certainly changed how we how it's impacted society. I mean, I'm looking at vitamin D and that whole process that has occurred. You know, warfarin, which is used a lot in blood thinning, was another research activity started here as a research activity and then expanded out. And I think that's the other unique thing on campus is how we collaborate with WARF. So as we do the basic research on campus, as discoveries are made and as people begin to realize what those potential applications are, the collaborations with WARF then help get some of those activities out into society and to benefit society. So, yeah, Mark, I would say definitely there's stuff that's going on right now that will make life better in 20 years. What that is, that's yeah. Why we have to invest in a lot, right? Because
right.
We really don't know what will be the payoff.
The first thing that came to my mind was the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, which has been going a long time and is continuing to go on, and the kind of work that goes on there in terms of solving our energy needs for the future, I think that's an example of something that 20 years down the road, I think is going to, well, it's already paying dividends, but will pay even more down the road.
Yeah, I think that is a great example. And the fact that it didn't come to me is I'm going to get yelled at by the director of that program, right? Because that's exactly what they're trying to do. That's one of those programs where they're doing basic research with the ultimate goal of how do we improve the energy situation across the nation and the globe.
Yeah. Mark, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Ron in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I email volunteered for the COVID-19 plasma transfusion research. Do the donors have to have the same A, O, or B blood type as the donor? And could a donor request which nurses, doctors, janitors who are still working inside hospitals be high on the priority list for, if their plasma is suitable? I don't know. This is real new research, so you may not have heard much about it yet.
Yeah, no, I've heard that people are donating plasma, and I'm not sure. But if I say it wrong, I'm sure people will correct me, which is the great thing about being on this show, is that once you do plasma, I'm not sure your blood type matters that much. But I'm not 100% sure of that. And so, I know that they're collecting plasma on campus as well as other sites across Madison and the county. I'm not sure that you can prioritize where they go. where if you donate your plasma, where it would go. But I, from all the discussions I've been on with regard to COVID-19, there is a lot of concern in terms of prioritizing and make sure that we prioritize health officials and first responders. So my guess would be that they're already on a priority list.
Ah, that makes sense. Ron, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Someone else was wondering how a research idea goes from an idea to actually being researched.
Boy, that's a really good question, because I think there's many things that germinate an idea in terms of pursuing a research topic, right? Some of it is research that you're already doing, and as you go through that process, you observe something or you see something in the data or in your model that is unexpected, right? And so you then pursue what caused that unexpected observed characteristic or calculated characteristic. And then with that, a lot of times then you'll hypothesize, so what are the options that could cause that? And you'll start to develop a plan to pursue that research path. And then a lot of research costs dollars, costs money to do. And so at that point, then you start looking at, in order to follow that path, in order to address that hypothesis, what are the resources you would need? And that could vary from hiring a graduate student to, you know, developing a center that would have multi-million dollars worth of equipment. And then the process would then begin of one, either directly going to federal agencies or private industries or philanthropical organizations to get funding to pursue that research. Or in some cases, they'll come to our office and put forth the idea of what they want to do, and then present an idea about the data they would need to be able to collect or the preliminary work they would need to do in order to point out that their research plan is far enough along and has data that can demonstrate that this is something useful to pursue. And then with that, they would go to a federal agency, as an example, NSF or NIH, to secure funding to continue with that study. And so that's one of the things that our office does, is help invest in those preliminary types of research studies that may provide fruit down the road for a research topic as well as an impact on society.
And when researchers are out there asking for money, there's something called overhead that comes into play at the university level. And I think that's always an interesting piece of this whole thing. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so a lot of times people forget that to do research, you need infrastructure, right? So as an example, just going through the process of submitting a grant, there's a lot of people on campus that have to process that grant, and get it submitted to the appropriate agency to make sure that it's formatted and has all the required certifications and documentations before it gets submitted. So there are people doing that. And then, of course, once you get in your lab, you know, there's electricity to pay for. There's ground facilities to take care of. There's building maintenance to take care of. And so some of the indirects, or most of the indirects, that are charged on a grant are actually being used to support the infrastructure that enables that research to be conducted. So each federal grant goes in with the work required to meet the objectives of the research, but then also the indirects are the resources that are going to provide the infrastructure to actually support the conducting of that research.
And that's typically, what, 40% or something of the total?
It actually has been creeping up. So it is now on the order of 50%, maybe even 53%. So it's very expensive to do research. As you, I think as we all know, just the way we live our lives, costs are increasing. You know, just to maintain a building the resources to do that are creeping up. And so there's a whole big complicated formula to determine what the percentage should be. And our university works with the federal government in doing their calculation and then determining what the percentage should be with regard to the indirect charge to a grant.
Steve Ackerman, our guest today, he is Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Questions for him as we talk about research, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Natalie Guyette, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at research at the UW during COVID-19 and beyond with our guest today, Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Have you been involved in a research study or know someone who has? Other questions about the research process, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Olivia in Dubuque, Iowa, up next with a question. Hi, Olivia.
Well, my husband was involved in a research study for C. diff in the fall. We live in Dubuque, and he was helicoptered from Dubuque to Madison, very seriously ill, and they figured it out. He had C. diff. He had been in the hospital with lots of medications prior to that. Well, we were offered the opportunity to participate in a C. diff study if he ever had to take antibiotics again. Well, in December, he was back at Madison, and he was involved in a C. diff study. Basically to see if vancomycin or, you know, would help recurring C. diff. He went through the study. We worked with Kendra from the study, and it was excellent, and he's had no recurrence of C. diff. We have no idea if he took the placebo or the vancomycin, but we were very pleased. It was a very easy procedures to go through. We had to mail stamps. Samples back or air freight them back, but that was all taken care of in the study, and it was excellent. So just wanted to give that comment. Thank you.
And C. diff, ma'am, is Olivia, is?
That's that terrible intestinal infection. Ah. You do not want, if you take too many antibiotics, it kills all the bad bacteria, and the good bacteria and the bad bacteria grow. You don't want even your worst enemy to have C. diff. It's awful.
All right. Olivia, thank you. Comment, Steve?
Great that her husband took that on and participated in that study because, you know, as we're looking to find cures for a variety of diseases, at some point we need to be looking at how that is impacting individuals, how that's impacting people. And to get to that stage where you're doing those clinical trials, it's really important to get volunteers to do that. And I'll also say that to get to that point really required a lot of approvals and certifications to make sure that it is a safe type of study to conduct. Again, it's wonderful that you participated in that because that's the type of work that needs to be done if we're going to find, if not a cure for C. diff, at least a treatment that's really effective.
Yeah. And Olivia mentioned placebo. And, you know, that has to be, I guess, an important part of a research program. And talk about why that's the case.
Yeah. So in order to do a lot of research, particularly along this with regard to medicines and how the body would interact with them, is you have to do a statistics where you have your trial cases that are occurring, and then you have those cases where everything, they don't know if they're participating, but what they're taking is really not being impacted by the medicine that they're taking. So in statistics, when you're looking at anything with regard to even preferences of people's taste, you know, you have the test case that's going on where you're administering an activity for an individual, and then you have your null case where these people aren't being treated any different than anybody else. And then by having those two cases, the null case and the test case, you can run statistics on that and determine whether or not the treatment is statistically significant or just random that it worked.
Olivia, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it very much. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been involved in a research project or questions about the research project process itself or funding for research? Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Had an email from a listener who's wondering what kind of research is being done with autism and intellectual disabilities.
So I know with autism, we do have the Weissman Center, and so that's one of the areas where they're looking at autism and how it impacts individuals and how to treat it and how to care for it as well, or care for the individual who's afflicted. There's also an Alzheimer's disease center on campus as well that's beginning to develop, and I know there's also a diabetes research center that's trying to be formed. And so, you know, these type of center activities where you bring together a whole group of experts in a variety of different fields, whether it be the human body, chemistry, biology, medicine, in order to take on these really complex conditions is really important. And I think that we have a number of centers dealing with autism and other areas across campus.
I got an email from Ketzel, who says that many first-year graduate students starting in fall of 2020 are considering deferral as there's a possibility of classes being online for fall semester this year due to COVID-19. How will that affect research and grant funding?
That's a really good question. You know, every year we do have graduate students who will defer for 1 year for one reason or another. Usually it's not that many. But, yeah, we're looking in the fall semester and wondering how many will defer if we have to move a lot more of our educational activities online. We haven't made that decision yet about going online or not, but you can imagine there's a lot of discussion about what does the fall semester look like. And along those lines, because it is very complex about what to do and how to do it, I have, working with the dean of the graduate school, we've put together a committee that's going to look at what does the fall look like for incoming graduate students and ones that are already here, you know, in a variety of situations, right? One situation is we're back to normal. You know, we're able to handle it by doing distance from each other. What you call that now? Right, you know,
yeah, stay 6 feet away.
Right, yeah, staying 6 feet away. You know, so that situation where everything gets under control, to the situation of we're doing everything online, and you're not allowed to come to campus, and how do we handle that situation? To somewhere in between, right, where we get to the point of, you know what, we can bring a lot of people on campus to do research, to participate in their graduate education, but there's going to be some situations where the graduate student may feel uncomfortable coming to campus, but still wants, you know, physically come to campus, but still wants to come to the university. So we formed a committee of faculty and staff to look at those issues and to come up with recommendations. I think it's by mid-June maybe early June. So we started trying to come up with options on how to answer that question because it's a tough one.
Yeah, and there's so many things up in the air. You know, we just... the amount of planning that has to be done is like four times as much as normal, because you have to come up with plans for all those different circumstances.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of times we're not sure what the circumstances will be. You know, we've seen decreasing amount of positive COVID-19 tests, you know, in Dane County over the last few days. But we don't know if there's going to be a spike upward again. So the impact of COVID-19 on the population and the community around us, right? Because it's not just bringing people to campus to do work. A lot of those people, particularly graduate students, are going to be living in the community. And so what's the community doing, the city, by that I mean with regard to the community, doing to try and make sure that the disease doesn't spread?
There's been some talk, and there's been, with COVID-19, some of the sort of normal kinds of applications for funding are, I don't know if they're set aside, but maybe there are special circumstances for when something like this happens that money can become available more quickly. I know one of our faculty members in my department, Life Sciences Communication, received some funding along with others within, she's pairing up with others within the university for some funding that was the National Institutes of Health was able to very quickly provide funding for, in light of, and it had to do with the, it has to do with the COVID-19.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the federal agencies have been really good about opening up new programs and fast-tracking them. So they still get peer-reviewed. They just quickly operate with regard to the panels to make decisions, to make recommendations, and then to release that money. And I think there's been a couple of folks on campus that have gotten these grants awarded so that they can start work on it really quickly. And I know there's a lot more. I checked over the weekend, and in the last 2 weeks, there's been 70 research proposals submitted that deal with COVID-19. So, you know, the powerhouse of our university in terms of this research is taking aim at COVID-19 from a variety of aspects, both the how does the disease spread to how you communicate the dangers to the actual biological conditions of how does it affect the human body.
Yeah, there are, I know a number of faculty members in my own department, I think, have applied, and some like Kai-Ping Cheng have received those dollars. I think another interesting thing, as we look at sort of the global research that's going on, under normal or typical situations, somebody gets is working on some research, and that is, they keep their own research and don't necessarily share much until they have results, statistical results perhaps, to share with others. But it seems like in this age that we're getting a lot more sharing of information as things are happening in the way of research.
Yeah, I think the results of various research studies are getting out there much quicker. And that's really good. I think the peer reviewing structure, you know, is also modified so that rather than just submitting it to get it published in a journal, which still occurs, and again, those journals are also increasing the rate at which these types of research studies are being published. But I think the other aspect that we're seeing is, yeah, people are sharing that data out there. They're putting it on the web and making it available for other people to get, to bring down, and to use as they try and find ways that we can fight this pandemic.
Yeah, I was listening to another researcher talk on a TED Talk kind of thing, and she was saying that there gets to be some pretty quickly peer review of that sort of thing when it is published without going through a referee journal, that if there's something not right in terms of what some other researcher thinks, that they're pretty quick to report back and get that information out as well. So there's a lot of back and forth going on.
Right, yeah. And so, I think that's key. And I think as people begin to, you know, try and explore as they're home, sitting home from work, looking at what the results are and what the latest research is to be very careful about the material that you're getting and making sure that it is coming from qualified resources.
Let's take another call. Kathy in Madison, it's your turn now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted, I actually thought of calling because of the caller who mentioned the autism research studies. And
yeah.
Our family was in an autism research study that might still be going on. It started when my son, well, we got in it when my son was 11. And they would, it was kind of busy at first, but a researcher would come to our house. It was extremely confidential. Once I ran into her at a CSA farm and she pretended not to know me or anyhow, she's very circumspect. And I'm trying to look, oh, here it is. Here's the study in the file. But it was about autism over the lifespan. And so I guess we started in it in 1998, and it went on for a long time, but every time, here's the last report I got, was report 17, and it was about researching older people, adults, teenagers, what happens after they get out of school, because there wasn't so much awareness of that, and I really appreciated being in the study. It made me think more. You know, sometimes they would interview my son, sometimes they'd interview me. They did a sibling research study, which was really good for my daughter. And I thought the whole process was very well organized and managed, and I don't know if they're doing it anymore or they ran out of funding. We haven't heard from them for a while, but every time they finished a chapter or a section, we'd get a wonderful report on it, and it was a real good experience for our family. My son liked it because he thought it was cool to be in the university.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that's great, again, to participate in it. I mean, it helps your family, but it also helps the researchers. And doing these long-term studies, I think, are really critical to see how age can impact a particular condition, which is really good. And it takes a commitment on your part, too, which is really appreciated. And it doesn't surprise me that, you know, that it's done so efficiently, because, again, in order to get to that stage where you're going out and interviewing individuals, particularly children, there's a whole process of approval, both on at the university but also at the federal level, to make sure that this is being done appropriately.
Yeah.
And safely for both, for the people who are being interviewed as well as for the researchers.
Yeah. Kathy, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I was thinking back to myself when I was in high school. I took part in a 4-day study, which tested my knowledge of all of the various areas, science, math, and so forth, and also what I had vision for my life. And I didn't know it at the time. I just took the test. I'm a 16-year-old. You do what you're told. You take the test. And later I realized it was part of a Stanford study called Project Talent. And it's following our lives throughout the year. And every 4 or 5 years, we'd get you'd get sort of an update. They kept track of everybody. And these are high schools all across the country as to, how are you ending up compared to how you tested?
on our campus, along those same lines of a long study at the Institute on Aging. I'm pretty sure that's where it's been located, is this project called MIDAS, Midlife in the United States. And so they're really looking at how people age. And again, that type of study really requires a long-term data set. So interacting with individuals, doing studies with those individuals, and those individuals, you know, willing to be a participant in that longitudinal study, which means you're crossing a very broad area of activities that you're looking at.
Yeah, it was interesting because I you know, these days of COVID, I was doing a little cleanup around the house, and I found the original. I had requested the information. They let me have my scores for all the various areas of math, science, and so forth. And they were happy to send it. And I had gotten it years ago, but I found it again. And I took that test when I was 16, and now I have a 16-year-old daughter. And wow. She took great joy looking through how I scored on various things compared to how she's doing in various areas. Some ways I was better, and some ways not as good, as she was very quick to point out. Oh, my gosh. Kathy has another question for us. Kathy, I'm sorry. You had a question about a follow-up question about the research lab.
So my husband was a professor at the UW-Madison from 1988 to 2016, and he came in as a young professor and was interested in powertrain control research in the mechanical engineering department. And he, over time, with help from Ford Motor and General Motors and various other things, built this incredible lab with all this fancy equipment, dynamometers, and, you know, stuff that was worth millions of dollars. And when he was ready to retire, he couldn't find another person who was interested in taking over this work. I don't know if the department looked to hire somebody, but he eventually retired, and this lab just dissolved and collapsed, and I don't know what happened to the equipment. But it was a remarkable program, and what provision does the university make for things to continue after someone has put a lot of time in it and the university has this gold mine?
Yeah,
that's a really challenging question. Because, and then I think there are generally two answers. One is that, and I've seen this a couple of times in both ways, where at the end of a research project, where you build up a lot of resources in a lab, that a department will hire somebody in that same field, and then there's a transition. So then that lab, that equipment continues to be used. And then there's also the other side where when somebody is retiring, the field has changed. And so the department wants to go into a new direction. And so they'll hire somebody else, you know, still maybe in mechanical engineering or whatever, but it's now taken on a new research avenue that's more appropriate to, you know, the 2020s. And then in that case is then, that lab of that faculty or whoever ends up being shut down, and that research of the whole department tends to shift into a new direction.
And what happens to the lab equipment and all of that? Does it gets reused?
Some of it gets reused because, you know, the equipment is oftentimes still useful, and so other people may take it on and bring it into their labs, or some of it may go to swap and then be available for sale to other universities or to the public in some cases, depending on what the equipment is.
Ah, there we go. Kathy, thank you again. I'm sorry we didn't get that question in the first time around. Appreciate it very much. And Steve, you're not going anywhere. You're going to stay with us. But I want to thank you for talking with us about the research going on at UW-Madison, $1.2 billion a year comes into the campus from UW faculty members. So it's a lot of money. And sometimes the results, the basic research results, aren't available. As one of our earlier callers said, maybe it's years down the road before they have an impact, but then the impact can be great. So thank you so much, but don't leave, because I think John Martin's going to join us next, and we'll talk weather. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.